October, because the last two lines is a very appropriate thing, I think, for us this evening. You know, send us not despairing home, send none unmoved away. It's not just a meaning to us here, but despair is something that Cooper knew very well, as we will see. I have a picture of him, not a photograph. Some of you may have seen that likeness of William Cooper. Funny sort of white headgear he seems to wear. Spelled Cowper, but I'm reliably told to pronounce Cooper. So I'm going to call him Cooper throughout. And it's taken me a while to get used to that. I've had to actually make my note Cooper all the way through in order to make sure that's what I do. He was born in 1741, and he died on the 25th of April, 1800, 217 years and 2 days ago. So he died at this time of year. That timing makes him a contemporary of Charles Wesley and George Whitfield, although 17 years younger than Whitfield, and indeed 24 years younger than Wesley. He was a remarkably complex individual. And like all complex Christians, there was much about him that was fascinating. However, also in common with complex Christians, dare I say it, there's much about him that was frustrating. He was incredibly sensitive and incredibly gifted. John Piper, speaking at the Tessian Conference of Pastors in 1992, read a paper entitled Insanity and Spiritual Songs in the Soul of a Saint about William Cooper. And he said this: I want to know why this man struggled with depression and despair almost all his life. I want to try to come to terms with insanity and spiritual songs from the same heart of one whom I think Cooper has been described as one of the very greatest of poets and was easily the most popular English poet of his day. Although he came to Gettysburg Castle very late on in his life, indeed, there's one biographer, Faye Cook, who says he was offered the position of poet laureate. He was that good. He's still regarded by people who know about poetry, and I'm not one of them. He's still regarded as one of the very greatest writers and letters, and that certainly is a skill that almost disappeared, I think, off the face of the earth today. He was a wonderful observer of life and nature, as well as being a gifted wit with an engaging sense of humour. Yet, on occasion, he suffered from deep depression. His spiritual mood seemed to go off the scale of both ends. John Piper said, the battles in this man's soul were of epic proportions. Now, the preparing his thoughts, I've been beset by two particular problems, and I crave your understanding for the deficiencies because of these problems, and they are, there is simply too much to consider. I have to wade through as much as I possibly can in the time I've had available, but there's an awful lot about Cooper. And that material is remarkably inconsistent, even on matters of fact. Indeed, much of the material contradicts much of the rest of the material. And even John Piper's conclusion that he struggled with depression and despair almost all of his life, in the first lecture, could well be just as placing rather too much of an emphasis on the heart empty fact. Let me illustrate something of Cooper's wit and skill. At the age of 61, he wrote little poem. It's an epitaph on Spot, and Spot was a dog belonging to Lady Throckmorton. This is his epitaph. Though once a puppy, and though Spot by name, here moulders one whose bones some honour claim, no spider man, though a spaniel race, and though no hound a martyr for the chase, these squirrels, rabbits, leverets rejoice. Your horns no longer echo to his voice. This record of his fate in melting view, he died worn out in vain pursuit of you. Yes, the indignant shame of Pop replied, and worn with vain pursuit, man also died. Yeah, it was there. You can almost picture the scribbles and the manual there and imagine the thoughts of the animals. Yet, choose the turn of the meaning towards the vanity of man. And here we have this, this mixture of interesting thought and spirituality that no really in Cooper. But I need to start really by opening up the issue of poetry and particularly Christian poetry. What is poetry? Only the definition. It is an art form in which human language is used for its aesthetic quality in addition to, or instead of, its notional and semantic content. Poems frequently rely for their effects on imagery, word association, and the musical quality of the language used. And if you remember that, if you interpret it, if you understand it, you're not doing that. I've often heard poetry referred to as painting with words. If you can understand why people would say that, there's a quality of poetry that in our present age, and especially with our modern image, we can easily miss. Around 75% of the Hebrew Bible was originally written as poetry. This has to mean that well over half of our Bible has originally given poetry. Amazing, isn't it? Why? Why do you think of this? Well, one reason may well be that the composition of the poem requires sharper thought. It is a matter of thought to word. And the end result is far superior for reciting, for singing, for memorizing. So there's a good reason why so much of the Old Testament was poetry. And the word cadence is often used to describe this added dimension to ordinary prose. The Oxford English Dictionary defines cadence as rhythm, measured movement, especially sound, full voice, especially at the end of period, intonation, close of musical phrase. The word cadenza comes in the same root as cadence. Now, Cooper in his hymns follow the normally accepted rules, meter and rhythm and rhyme, but his more prolific output was blank verse, similar to Shakespeare. This involved equal covenants of words, but the lack of rigidity provided more scope for feelings and emotions to come through in the poetry. This aspect of poetry being easier to remember than prose is particularly useful in some situations, isn't it? I can well remember poems that I was forced to learn at school. I'm sure we all can. And it's especially so in a hymn. How often it is valid to use hymns in our own devotion. And it's my great sorrow that many hymns that are capable of such use are some less and less nowadays. And this is denying the present generation of youth that this store of these wonderful truths in the poems in a hymn in their minds. Some of the phrases contained in Cooper's hymns have become part of our language. You know, it has 33 quotations in the Oxford Dictionary of Quotations. I tell you how many Charles Wesley has? Three. 33 for three. Cooper has 38 citations from one poem in the Oxford English Dictionary. But one little game I invented while I was doing it, can you spot the hymn from one line? See how you do it. Finish the verse in your mind. Don't carry it out with your life. What peaceful hours I once enjoyed. Can a woman's tender care speak towards the child she bears? The dearest idol I have known. Yeah? Lord, it is my chief complaint. Have you no words that are simple things? Oh, rend the heavens, come quickly down. The spirit grieves upon the earth. The dying feet rejoice to see. Sometimes the light has come. Judge not the Lord by speedy sense. And sinners plunge beneath that flood. The flood may have a bitter taste, but sweet will be the flood. You know, we could finish these pondered something. They stick in our minds. Here we have a man with a remarkable gift, but more important than that, that man was able to use that gift in the service of God and the enlightenment of future generations. I have 3 points. The first and the last are brief, the middle is the lead topic. The first one is just this particularly life when you're quick. Summary, so you know where we're going. Then we'll go through his life, picking out 6 key phases. And then I'll try and draw some conclusions so you might get something out of this situation, which is incredibly complicated, let me tell you. So in 1731, he was born in Bath, Hampstead, on the 15th of November, the father of the local Britain, son of the local Britain, who was. When he was 6, his brother John was born. His mother died just after childbirth, and only 2 out of 6 potential children lived. So here we have a vicar and his 2 sons and no mother when Truffaut was 6. He was then sent out to be a boarder at a school under the headmastership of Dr. Pittman in Margate, which was 9 miles away from Barcaster. He developed an eye problem while he was there, and he was severely bullied. Not sure about that. He then went, because of his eye problems, and lived with some oculists in London for 2 years, who were not Christians and had no Christian influence on his life at that stage. And in 1742, at the age of 12, he began at Westminster School. Now, Westminster School is a very famous school and institute for this day. Let me tell you some of the people who went there for their education. Dryden, Locke, with an E on the end. Christopher Wren, Hook, with an E on the end. The composer Purcell, Charles Wesley, Edward Gibbon, A.A. Milne, with the Pope, John Green Holt, Sir John Hughes, Kim Philby, Peter Ustinov, both Flanders and Swan, Tony Bent, Andrew Lloyd Webber. See, quite a list of names, isn't it? Of people who are incredibly skilled across a wide range of things, and that's the school he went to in 1743. And in 1748, he was admitted to the middle temple to train as a lawyer, and that was a kind of arrangement between the school and the middle temple. And he left school for a while then and went back home to live with his father for 9 months. And I think reading between the lines, he suffered then his first bout of depression. He was articled in 1750 at the age of 19 to a Mr. Chapman and spent a lot of time with his cousins. He had 3 female cousins, more of that too, later. He struck up a lifetime friendship with Harriet, who became Lady Heskin, one of his cousins, and he had a courtship with Theodora. He was called to the bar in 1754 and founded a member of the Nonsense Club. His father died in 1756 when he was 25. One of his close friends, the William Russell Brown, from the Thames, and he actually separated from Theodora, and he then had the first onset of real. He was admitted to the Inner Temple in 1759 and became Commissioner of Bankrupts. And at the age of 32, he was offered a significant post in the House of Lords. And he really found that exposed him too much, and he seriously tried to commit suicide in 4 different ways. That's quite interesting when you talk about that too. So he resigned his potential position in the House of Lords and moved into a family called Unwin as a lodger. The man of the family died, thrown off his horse, and he then met John Newton, and he and the man who died on the horse, the widow Mrs. Unwin, moved to a house near to Newton. His brother then died. He then compiled the only hymn book of Newton, many of the hymns that we will know that he wrote. But he then had very serious depression again, and Newton cared for him. He was physically restored and went back to live with Mrs. Unwin, and the only one were published, which was a great success. Newton then left the area, as it were, and went to London. He then, at the age of 49, wrote his first major poem called Thalestra or Antithalestra. He had a friendship with Lady Austin. He thought she was going to marry him, but she encouraged him to write more poetry. He wrote about John Gilpin, which is a humorous, light poem. But then he began at the age of 52 his longest, complicated poem called The Past. He began translating Homer, which is a great classicist. And The Past was actually published in 1754 and 1785, and he became nationally famous. Yet another story died at 10 at the age of 56. Mary Unwin had a stroke when he was 16. She got worse, he wrote home for her, and they moved to Norfolk. Mary died, and he was bereft. He wrote a poem called The Castaway, and he died the next year in 1800 and buried in the church. And you can see there's a lot of interest in the poem itself. So he had his despairing bouts, and he had his drive attempts, and he had all these things that came and went, and he never got married. So the first thing we look at more deeply is Eric's childhood. As I said, he was the fourth child John and Anne. The first three died in infancy after the fifth, but his brother, John, born 6 years later, his mother died. His father was a captain to King George II. His grandfather had been a famous judge. Indeed, his grandfather's brother was the first Lord Chancellor of England, Earl Cooper. On his mother's side, he was descended from Henry III and John Donne, the Puritan poet. So it was a big family of quite important people, and there was wealth there, but as a friend of mine once said about the topic of my company was making, it was kingly store. His mother died when she was 34 after giving birth to John. Now, whether that had a really big impact on that woman, which is hard to tell at this distant in time. But they tried to hide the sight of the Hearst leaving the house with a coffin from his eyes. Nevertheless, he saw it. And he wrote later, "I heard the bell toll on my burial day. I saw the hearse that bore me slow away, and turning from my nursery window drew a long, long sigh and wept the last of you." In a letter to his friend Joseph Hill, written 4 years after, he wrote that poem. He says, "This I can truly say that not a week passes, perhaps I might equal the rapidity of their day, in which I did not think of her, after the impression her tenderness made upon me, though the opportunity she had to show me was so short." And the final reflection of that in the hymn, "Hark, my soul, the Lord," where he says this, "Can a woman's tender care cease to always defile she can?" Feeling there of his affection for his mother and her affection for him. Yes. His father really refused his kiss on the hand, one just a baby, and Cooper himself would have kissed, sent him off to boarding school. Now, that seems a bit rough, but maybe it was customary in those days. Well, it was, but it's still quite a separation. I think he felt it. But he wrote sometimes, I didn't see what he said about the bullying that he endured there. "Here I had hardships of various kinds of conflicting, which I felt more sensitive and important for tenderness with which I had been to get at home. But my chief affliction consisted in my being singled out from all the children in school by a lad about 15 years of age as a proper subject upon whom he might let loose the cruelty of his temper. I chose to conceal a particular recital of the many acts of barbarity with which he made his business continually persecuted. It would be sufficient to say that he had, by his savage treatment of him, imprinted such a dread of his very figure upon my mind that I well remember being afraid to lift my eyes upon him higher than his knees, and that I knew him by his shoe bucket better than any other part of his face." So he was very bad and bullied when he was at school. Thankfully, the bully was expelled, not on after that, so he got his turn out. The eye problem meant that he went off to live with his oculist, and then he ended up at Westminster School, which produced a lot of lawyers. It was a very good school for that particular profession. Now, the most surprising thing we come across reading about Sir Cooper, apparently he excelled when he was at school at cricket and football. And then I was cricket and football. You know that? It was early in the So I then looked up the history of cricket and football because these sports were playing, even though they were. They were quite new, but they were quite seriously played by schoolboys in those days. And Cooper apparently excelled at it, and he was very keen on exercise. He walked long distances for people on. At the school, he had a very excellent teacher of classics, and that's why he took a real interest in Latin and some Hebrew. He worked hard, played hard. He ended up as head of his house, and he was ranked third in the academic system. But he had no real awareness of religion, the personal spirit, and he left school at the age of 17. He went back home shortly and then became article in the Middle Temple. But although he was being pushed towards a career in law or indeed in politics, he showed no real enthusiasm for either of these things. And it took him 12 years to get from the Middle Temple to the Inner Temple when he became a fully fledged barrister. But to do that, he had to have his 24 dinners and 6 exams. He just wasn't very keen on it. And his good friend William Haley said about him towards the end of his life, "The soul of Cooper had indeed fire, but fire so refined and ethereal that it could not be expected to shine in the gross atmosphere of worldly contention." The lawyers have done anything about worldly contention. This was a time when real signature was conceived. Now, we use the word today as being a job where you actually get paid for doing nothing. If in a way it was for doing very little. But it really existed. And if you had a signature, you legitimately had an income, and you really didn't have to do anything. And these signatures were worth something. They were passed on in families, and they were given to friends and those with influence. It was one of the things that my back has struck your thing. The sort of thing that Corbyn accused me of doing. But you know, it was all inside going on. They really existed. But Cooper had some very useful connections, and he began to cultivate friends from the literary text. He amused himself by translating ancient poets. Horace, for instance, he was very good at translating, and this is the like-minded friends that formed this nonsense club that I mentioned earlier. It was about the same time that he was called to the bar. And this nonsense club was really a dining and talking club. Hogarth, the artist, was a member of this club. Very well-connected people there. One biographer said of this time, and you know, having sung a super hit, and I know what I'm going to say in the rest of this talk, but the sort of man we know Cooper was, is really surprising. Cooper was all his life an elegant dresser. He fenced, he went shooting, he danced all night, went to Marylebone Garden, to the Italian Opera, and to the theatre. He could and did drink a considerable amount, and so his early letters show that he's pretty much a young man of society. Then he was quite successful, potential, very vital. He was beginning to write articles at this stage rather than poetry for a magazine called The Connoisseur, which isn't the connoisseur that existed since. There have been a number of magazines called The Connoisseur, and another a paper called The St. James's Chronicle. But throughout this whole period, he was quite usable, kind of lurking in his head. He went through what he referred to as what George Herbert did. George Herbert was a hymn writer and poet that preceded him, who wrote things like, "Teach me my God and King, you know, and all things you to see, and let all the world in every corner sing, my God and King." You may well know that. And Cooper said to him, the Herbert friend, "I found in them a strange piety which I admire. This was the only author I had any delight in reading." And there's just a slight strain of inventive quirkiness in Herbert's work. And you'll probably know this particular stanza. Herbert wrote it: "A man that looks on glass, on it may stay his eye, or it will freeze it to its path, and then the heaven is high." There's quite a kind of rhyming there, which is a light. But could also describe her as saying that it's been gossip and untruth. And he was advised by a dear relative that reading her book was far more likely to impress him further. But all this was leading him in a rather circuitous route towards God. He decided to pray. So here's the young man who was also a God. Right young man, always his gone and always nonsense currency. And he said there's such a good language out in the whole narrative that we never resort to him but in the dark instance when all creatures have failed to suffer. It might be satisfied, even though after appearances would say he was enjoying it. And he found himself increasingly taking a Christian point of view when he ended up in an argument with his friends. And he became very aware of his inconsistency within himself. He wasn't a Christian, but he was taking a Christian point of view. But he had lots of time on his hands. Just a few blocks away from his lodging, including three girls, the daughters of his uncle Ashley, his father's brother Ashley. Harriet, who was going to marry later and become Lady Hesketh. Elizabeth, and we don't hear much about her. And the lovely Theodora, the youngest. And we felt that he adored. And they spent a lot of time together. And with him was his great friend, who was also a friend of his intended servant, who later became the Lord Chancellor of England. One father who makes the point that Cooper at the stage was very attractive to him. He was good looking, he was good company, he had good Now, he just spent a lot of time poring over all the different ideas with regard to his relationship with Theodora, but his uncle Ashley, at this stage, didn't discourage it, but then did discourage it later on. But we can interpret it in a number of ways. It did become officially engaged, but then Ashley decided to say, no, you can't get married, and we don't know the reason why, but neither of them ever married anyway. So we could say, well, you know, that's unrequited love. What a terrible thing for him to happen to early on in his life. But there is not much evidence that Cooper himself was strongly affected by Theodora. He seems quite happy to have walked away from her at this stage. But he did write a poem. He wrote a lot of poems to her about the course of media and her. But this is an interesting one about his own view of this period of his life. He says this: William was once a bashful youth with modesty of touch, that one might say, to tell the truth, he rather had too much. Some say it was for want of sense, and others want of spirit, so blessed that thing with instruments, while others could not bear it. But some of different notion had that as each other winking observed that only little said, he put it off his thinking. However, it happened by degrees he mended with further, and company was more at ease, and dressed a little smarter. Nay, now and then he could look quite gay, as other people do, and sometimes said, or tried to say a little thing or two. He eyed the women, and made free to comment on their shapes, so that there was, or seemed to be, no fear of that. The women said, and thought him rough, but now no longer foolish, the creature knew him well enough, but wants a view of color. At length, improved from head to heel, so scarce too much to say, the dancing bows so gentil, or half so dégagé. Now that the miracle so strange may not invent it show, let the dear maid who wrought the change in claiming for her for her own. And you think how he must have had the man. But it wasn't what he wanted at all. Ashley appears to have had influence over free signature in the House of Lords, which is his uncle Ashley, owed to jobs, reading clerk and clerk of the journal. The reading clerk job was the best, but it required rather too much responsibility for Cooper Brighton, so he decided to go for the clerk of the journal position. Yet, over all this classy enjoyment and promise of advice, which was a growing pressure. Spiritual pressure, social pressure too, economic pressure too. And William was just in time to cope with pressure. So he encountered the third section of his life, which I call Life Not Quite So Easy. It seemed to get a bit difficult from here on. The death of Sir William Russell, his friend, drowned in pain. The death of his father in 1756. And then there were those around who took exception to the sinecure arrangement. And the House of Lords decided to interview the applicant at the bar of the house. He was to be allowed 6 months, preparation for that appeal, and come before the bar of the House of Lords, and all the lords could ask him questions before he could actually take this job. So there he was, young man, good looking, intelligent, a woman prepared to marry him, and that did seem at that stage he was likely to call to action. He decided on his great sister, the daughter. Now, most biographers are unaware of this, but 7 years later they met her, and she asked him why he didn't work with her. And he said, yes. Oh, yes, I saw the paradise before me, but I also saw the flaming sword that must forever keep me from it. And I didn't understand that one. And it's pretty disgraceful, but that's what he said. Any man. He was especially worried about the unfeasible world. Those whose spirit, he said, are formed like mine to be a public exhibition of themselves on any occasion with mortal poison may have some idea of the horror of the situation. Others can have none. My continuing misery at length brought on a nervous tremor. Quiet forsook me by day, quiet forsook me by day, and sleep by night. Now, one of Cooper's most recent biographers, a man called Neil Curry, has quite a skeptical stance about Cooper in a book he calls A Revaluation. And I doubt very much that Curry is looking at Cooper as a Christian as well. And it makes his view of Cooper especially interesting. On the flying summary of the book, it says that undeniably one of the great poets of this work shows, Cooper nevertheless sought inspiration using people and resources, often ruthlessly to that end. He is shown to have had ultimately a highly defensive view of himself to enable him to work and live paradoxically on his own terms. So here we are in 1756, with Field and Wesley having attracted the evangelical thinking in England for a few years. In fact, they were arguably in their time. And Curry believes that some of Cooper's written rhetoric was influenced by the need to follow an evangelical pattern at this point. He uses the term, which I never heard before I read this, rhodomontade, to describe this kind of sanctimonious posting. And, you know, it brought to my mind something that does disturb me more, I think, about it, and it's public testimony. There can be something positive coming and people can stand up and try to outdo this public act. And you love to be paid for that, whether or not it's dangerous. It's dangerous. And there's an end for it. Rhodomontade. And then, I'll read you what Curry said about it. Straightforward narrative is that he had evangelical rhodomontade. And it's difficult to know where the truth lies. A whole new direction is taken. Now came the great temptation, the point to which Satan had all the while been drawing me with his superlative writing. The dark and hellish purpose of self-murder in terms of a conversion narrative. This is quite magnificent, a sin quite unlike any other, and a sin from which he has to be saved by divine providence. But as the events unfold, it becomes more and more unbelievably melodramatic and falls from the common, and the tone is not helped by the frequent conclusion of such assertions as, thus were the emissaries of the throne of darkness. So you can see something in what Curry is saying there, which is right or wrong. I leave it up to you to decide, but what happens next when you take it with a pinch of salt or not, we really only have Cooper's words to tell us what happened next. He was obviously a little wreck. No question about that, with this interview coming up before the bar of the house. And he regarded any public appearance as being absolutely just. And he decided a week from the actual day when he was going to have to go through this, he decided to commit suicide. And he received confirmation, he believed at the time, from the Lord that he ever heard two men talking about this self. So, so he went out to a chemist and bought some laudanum, tried to take it, failed, but kept it around. And on the day before his appearance to the house of God, he decided he drowned himself, because he really couldn't bring himself to take the quote. So he got a coach down to Tower Wharf, but when he got there, he found his pipe was out. So he had to wade through. He also found that there was some men watching, and he thought they might rescue him. So he got back in a tent and went back. Tried to take the Lord in when he got home, failed once again. So he got this, so he got out his pen knife, decided, broke his pen knife, and went to sleep. So he got right, I'll try something else. So he took off his stocking, and with his garter, he made a noose and put it around his neck, and made it advice that he could put it at a four post of bed. He threw over the top of the bed, and he was going to jump off the bed and dangle from it. So he tried that. He broke the bed first. And thought, this is a good. I mean, it does sound like a comedy, doesn't it? But this is how you relate it. So he said, I use the door. The door's not going to come off. And I can hang it over the door, get on the chair with the seat, and then jump off, take the chair away, that's it. That's what he did. His landlady found him unconscious on the floor, but still alive, and he revived. But because of that, he obviously didn't go to the interview at the House of Lords the next day. He describes the state of mind like this, that every stroke, my thoughts and expressions became more wild and incoherent. When they ceased, they left nothing but disorder and a confused imagination behind them. All that been made clear was the sense of sin and the expectation of punishment. His friends and family felt that they couldn't do him at this obviously. So they arranged him to go to what is described rather quaintly as a private madhouse in St. Albans, run by a doctor Cotton. Tobit is reported as having been very slow, and self-harm was never far away. But and Cooper himself said that at the time their conviction of sin and expectation of instant judgment never left him. His brother kept trying to tell him he was deluded and that forgiveness was possible. But Cooper didn't mean that. But we now have another strange two incidents that are rather strange. He found an open Bible twice on a bench in the garden of this private murder. The first time it was an account of the raising of Lazarus. And Cooper did have an incredible influence by the gentleness and care that Jesus showed around the place. Then the next time he came across this, that he gave it was opened in Romans chapter 3, whom God has set forth to be a propitiation through faith in his blood, to declare his righteousness for the remission of sins that are passed through the forbearance of God. He said, the full beam of the Son of Righteousness shone upon him, and he saw himself pardoned and sealed in Christ's blood. This is 1764, he's now 33 years ago. He was so enthusiastic that he was inquisitive that Dr. Cotton was very suspicious and maintained a close watch on him. For a further year, he was praying all the time and apparently happy all the time, almost being happy to sleep. His state of mind was described as, I remember the pollution which is in the world and the sad share I had in it myself. And my heart ached at the thought of meeting him. When he left this private manor house, he took his personal valet with him, Sam Roberts. The idea of having a personal valet in a manor house quite babbles me. But it took Dr. Cotton some persuading to let him go. They also took a young local drunk, Dick Coleman, with them, but that was rather wrong. His brother secured lodgings for him and Sam Roberts in Hungary. And Cooper threw himself into his new place with outrageous enthusiasm, but he was less than capable of looking after himself in the real world, even with a man. The fourth phase then of life between the age of 34, and it went on right towards the end, right near the end of the 60s. The lodgings were proved temporary because he met a young man in the church called Will Unwin. Now, Will was the son of Maureen and Mary Unwin, and had a sister called Susanna. At this stage, Cooper was 34, Mary Unwin is 41, and Maureen Unwin, her husband, is 51, 20 years older than her. But the friendship blossomed, that Cooper went to Munster and Rome were all very well, and decided to move into their house as a paying lodger, and they welcomed him. And now Mary Unwin becomes a fundamental part of Cooper's life. She is described by one of Cooper's biographers as having this most greater man than any other human creature in shaping and colouring his life. This was a complex relationship, clearly. Part mother, part older sister, part fan, but I think we can be certain they were never lovers. She writes this: Mr. Cooper, as he always called him, was always turning my thoughts to matters of religion. This was a blessing to me because my husband, although a minister of the church, was not in sympathy with my recent conversion. He did not believe in the divinity of Jesus Christ or the infinite merits of his suffering. He showed me a horoscope in this day that some end of the real concerned now. Cooper provides us with an account of how they spent their average day. 9 to 11 a.m. read scriptures for sermons. 11 to 12 have a service for an hour. 12 to 3 private reading, walking, writing, or gardening. 3 to tea time, religious conversation and hymn singing. After tea, a robust walk. And after dinner, hymns, reading of the sermon, and prayers. And Cooper writes to a wife of a cousin this: I need not tell you that such a life of this is consistent with the utmost cheerfulness. Accordingly, we are all happy and well together in unity with them. Seems fine, doesn't it, that after 18 months, Morley's horse panicked, the husband of Mary, and threw him to the ground in the head. And he has specifically asked Mary not to feel that Cooper should leave if he should die. So they were confronted together by a financial hardship, more houses than this, and the curate from nearby old John Newton visited them to offer condolences. They got on very well with him, and so they decided to move to Oldham houses arranged for them next door, basically, to where Newton was the afternoon. They arrived there in 1797, and John and Mary Newton accommodated them so their new home was ready. Now, you will notice I think John was a little curious at home, but this was all that. This is one of those things that he had been in the care of agriculture, but how we were in the other place. But this was a centre for good preaching. Henry Venn preached there, Andrew Fuller preached there, William O'Neill preached there, William Hill preached there, John Berridge preached, John Lyon preached, and George Whitfield preached. There was also a very good practice in Olney. It was a sylvan place. I have a time to prove that, but I wouldn't take the time to read it to you. But this was a tranquil period in terms of life. But Mary Ellen became ill, and Cooper feared she would die and wrote that. Look this, in this fascinating, oh that I may rejoice to surrender up to the Lord my dearest comforts the moment he shall require me. That's kind of good. And around this time, his hymn writing ability began to blossom. He wrote, "Oh, for a closer walking path, a calm and heavenly frame, a light to shine upon the road that leads me to the land." And he wrote, "The dearest idol I have known, whatever that idol do, he helped me to tear it from my throat and get it from you." Mary began it. And around this time, through the battle, died brother for a month and 4 days. And became an encourager of his brother, the Lord Bruce. The fifth period was his friendship with Newton, which really lasted in its fullness the whole time Newton was curate in Ireland, from 1765 to 1777. Newton's background, of course, was far better known than Cooper. Drunk, blasphemer, womanizer, lawless, deserter, slave, and slaver, and yet ultimately the humble convert of the Christ we have in mind. And these two men had such different personalities, mutual, outgoing, and confident, the opposite to Cooper. But Cooper wrote this because two angels came down from heaven to execute the divine command, and one was appointed to conduct an empire, and the other to speak of Sicily. They would feel no inclination to exchange his voice. You know, it's really different from Newton, but he felt no difficulty in that situation. Newton's pace of living was very hard for people to develop. Indeed, Lady Hester noted in some of her letters that I cannot help thinking they might have made better use of a fine summer evening by shutting themselves up to make long prayers. So, as an aside, I'd ask the question, really, is it to be too mysterious? There's a question, we'll put it back on. Is it possible to be too spiritual? You see, when Paul says in 1 Timothy 3, he must have a good testimony for talking about elders among those who are outside, that he falls from the reproach and the snare of the text. If you have the same mind mixing with outside, living in the world, living well in the world. But, on the other hand, not the big day, there are 6 days when we participate in the world, neighbouring, Christian, neighbouring, or whatever brings our income. So, I'd answer the question I pose. It's not possible to be too spiritual, but it is possible, I think, to get out of balance sometimes in the way we handle things. Newton was no fool, and he saw that Cooper required a challenge. He got into the prayer meeting, and I was just so treated with fear and horror in the prayer meeting. He would spend 5 hours training before the start of the meeting that he brought friendship to the prison. And the friendship between these two men blossomed. Both had lost their mothers at the end of the day. Both had fallen in love at a relatively young age. In fact, Newton fell in love with a girl who was 13 when he was a teenager. And after all his blasphemy and all his womanizing and all his comfort of coming up, he went back to her and married her, and she became his wife. They had business with pretending no meaning in the village. And he wrote a little poem which I love as a description, which of the antinomian. The pardon such presume upon, they do not beg, but steal. And when they see it at the throne, so where's the spirit to be? Neat in describe antinomianism as it goes well. Newton had a habit that Cooper didn't have, smoking a pipe. Around this time, Susanna Unwin, the daughter of the Unwin, married. She married another churchman. So Mary and William were left alone to start. And this led to gossip. And Mary writes this, it was not sufficient evidence of virtue for the people of Olney, my son and my son-in-law, both ministers. Likewise, our neighbour and friend, John Newton, and that none of them found fault. The perception of scandal surrounding our friendship brought us both so low in spirit, and in autumn 1772, for my sake, we became engaged. The step which had been taken to lessen the gossip only served to certainty. Yes, I mean, I wasn't surprised that it stoked the gossip. And, you know, that period was another difficult period for Cooper. He was so sensitive, these things really affected him. And it may have well have been a catalyst for the clouds he so much dread on the horizon, because in 1773, he fell into another deep depression dominated by his fear of his own conscience. At this time, he wrote, God moves through the Newton wrote about him, my dear friend, still walks in darkness. I can hardly conceive that anyone that has faded grace and favour with God can be in greater distress. And yet no one walks more closely with him or works desperately devoted to him in all things. In February, after a month of depression, prevailing night. This had a profound impact on her at the time, and the horror of it occurred throughout the rest of his life. Now, the details are sketchy, but the Lord in his night was telling me that he, above all, had no hope. He was undoubtedly convinced that he was lost, alone in the whole of humanity, in that he was both met and lost. He couldn't believe it. He said, well, he couldn't believe an election then, but that was what he said he believed. They sent the doctor Cotton, he had him in the night out, and he couldn't do anything for him. After months and months, he gradually recovered. He went to stay with the Newtons. And when he was there, he began writing the Only Hymns. And the Only Hymns were very influential throughout the world, particularly in the USA. And the Newtons went away on holiday, and while they were away, insufferable. But that depression healed, and he moved back to live with Mary in the house they called Orchard Farm. Now, again, he comes up with surprises. You might expect him to ruminate and be dismayed, but no, he took up carpentry and gardening. He also threw himself into companionship animals. A dog, rabbit, cat, and three hares, and four pets, what he tiny. He wrote poems about his pets, including an epitaph for tiny. That was when he took up artistry and reading travel books. He even started taking his pupils and teaching his classes. Newton moved to London in 1737 to a church called Mary Woolnoth in Lombard Street, which is near where it's actually England. There's no doubt that Cooper and Newton were very close friends. They spent a great deal of time together. And there's wide agreement that Cooper was the father of poets and Newton. But there are examples of Cooper's inventiveness in verse being actually criticized by Newton. He thought it was too glorious. But it was a very mutually beneficial relationship. But the same was not true of the new theorist and Cooper, and again, had time on his own. So his final phase of life, maturity, it's about 20 years from 1780 to 1800. Having tried many kinds of activity and derived some enjoyment from it, at the age of 50, he felt he still hadn't discovered his true calling. Intellectuals began to write, and it becomes his most productive period, as this requires both stimulus and breakthrough. Breakthrough in terms of publication. You're hawking one's talent around publishers is not the easiest thing to do. And if you're a very shy, reserved person like people, it's going to be very difficult. But the stimulus came from the fact that Martin McDan, a Christian cousin who had helped Cooper back in 1763, his depression then, he published a book entitled Eleuthera or a Treatise on Female Rule. And this book actually outraged the evangelical establishment because it strongly supported polygamy, namely from that. Saying that it was to do with women on the street, he started to go and several of them, man, a Christian man, Martin McDan said it was a good thing, and that outraged a lot of people. So Cooper wrote a poem against that particular view. And Newton eventually got it published. And Mary Unwin saw how that the authorship of that had been good for Cooper. He'd been concentrating on something, so she persuaded him to write more. He blank wrote poetry, and he wrote poems on the progress of terror, 600 lines, truth, table talk, population, hope, charity, conversation, and retirement, all published in 1782 under the title Poems by William Cooper of the Temple. A mixed response, but soon the originality began to be praised by critics, even though it had been 10 years since his last serious bout of depression, he was beginning to get depressed again. Then he met the cousin of the Greenberg's book, He Well Versed Women, and invited them round to tea the next day. Then he got very worried about meeting tea, very shy. But they came. One was Lady Anna Austin, a widow and an actual evangelical, and a strong friendship was struck up. And it may be that that avoided, helped him avoid depression. In fact, he wrote at that time The Diverting History of John Gilpin, of which you may have heard. Now, it may not have been modern literature, but people then thought that was quite funny. He also wrote a poem, The Nightingale and the Glowworm. Is that just another flavour of how he was? And a nightingale that all day long had cheered the village with his song, nor yet had he his notes suspended, nor yet had he his eyes suspended. He quite appealed as well as he might. This is the demand of happiness. Well, the thing is to be around quite far off upon the ground, as something shining in the dark, and in the glow-worm by the star. So scooting down from hawthorn top, he thought to put him in his crop. The worm of Erebus came to land him thus, like eloquent. Think you of my man, quoth he, as much as I your mistress is. I would have thought to do thee. You would have thought to do me wrong, as much as I could spoil your tongue. For twas a self-same power divine taught you to sing, and you to shine. That you would need it, I would like to make you be quiet and cheer to me. Interesting. Confirmation between what happened there. And a glowworm, that was the kind of thing that he used to do. Lady Austin moved into accommodation with the British man's door and began to spend a lot of time with him. And she suggested to him that he settle down to write an even longer poem. And he said, well, you've got something like that. So she said, well, all right, start with that first one. He wrote, great enthusiasm about the paper, and it moved on and on and on, and it became known as the Tart, his most famous poem. It's over 5,000 miles. Not the moon, but it's quite common. It's so famous.